Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by reviews editor Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And this week, we'll be reviewing several new releases, including Luca Guadagnino's sexy tennis love triangle Challengers, space thriller ISS, weepy true story Ordinary Angels, animated action comedy Spy X Family Code White, and we'll also be reviewing ultra-violent revenge thriller Boy Kills World, starring Bill Skarsgård, and we'll be hearing from that film's director, Moritz Moore. But first, Matthew, have you been watching anything else this week or been to any sort of film events?
Well, I have, yeah. Well, it's kind of inspired by the Tarantino announcement that he's not going to be making the film Critic. I've finally got around to watching the Pauline Kael documentary called What She Said, which I've been trying to find for ages, and then I discovered it's on Sky Arts. So I just watched it on Sky Arts, yeah. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that. That was really interesting to learn about her life. The amount of influence she had back in the day. I mean, I don't think there's ever been another film critic on her level that kind of inspired so much, both devotion and kind of vitriol as well. I mean, if she gave a good or a bad review. So that was really fascinating, and lots of detail about how she effectively raised film reviewing to an art form. So I'd highly recommend that if you've got any interest in that side of the business. It was a really interesting watch.
Oh, cool. I'll check that out. I've kind of watched a few things this week. I had a long haul flight, so I kind of mopped up a couple of things I'd missed over like the past year. So I caught up with The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which I hadn't seen, which was good. Scrapper, which I quite enjoyed. I never actually saw that. It was on when I sort of covered Sundance the year. That was like a couple of years ago, I think that was. But yeah, didn't ding around seeing it, but enjoyable little film. And we'll sort of talk about this more next week, but I went to the special screening at the BFI IMAX of The Fall Guy this week as well, which was enjoyable. But like, we'll save that proper discussion for next week. And of course, I mean, it goes without saying that obviously I watched the new episode of Bluey as well. The surprise episode called Surprise. Very good. Another little short episode. Very enjoyable. Always happy to have more Bluey in my life. And I hope we do get some more Bluey in whatever form it is in the future. I'm happy to wait as long as they release some good quality Bluey down the line.
There's got to be a movie, surely. I mean, it's huge, isn't it?
It's taken
on such a global smash now.
You'd think. Guaranteed Total Film cover if it ever does a movie.
And who will do the feature?
Well, there'll be a real fight to the death between me and Jordan, I think, yeah.
You Bluey fans on the team.
Anyway, on to new releases now, and we're going to start with this roaring rampage of revenge.
I saw this man take down an entire squad.
I did do that.
He killed over 100 men.
Slight exaggeration.
With his bare hands.
Definitely not true. Wait.
You forget who controls the narrative.
Not exactly how I plan to go.
So this is Boy Kills World, an OTT revenge movie starring Bill Skarsgård as Boy, whose family is murdered. And as you might be expecting, he sets about seeking bloody revenge. Now, Boy doesn't speak, but we do hear his inner voice, which has been inspired by his favourite computer game. And that voice is provided in the film by H. John Benjamin, who you might recognise as Bob Belcher from Bob's Burgers. Now, before we review this film, our deputy online entertainment editor, Faye Watson, recently sat down with the film's director, Moritz Moore, and here's what they spoke about.
Read my lips.
You petulant little...
Repeat the mantra. I am an instrument shaped for a... Damn it.
It's been quite a long road to get to this point for you, hasn't it? How does it feel to kind of finally be at that finish point?
Overwhelming. It's been crazy. Like we went out last night to the movies, and just seeing your own advertisements coming up and flashing over the screens, that was a very surreal feeling after the eight years.
I was reading you kind of started out with this short film that you created and then kind of took that to Hollywood to try and get it sold. Is that right?
Yeah, more or less. It sort of was a proof of concept trailer where you sort of show what a movie could look like. It's not really a short with a close story, but sort of it was a scene and then a little action scene and then a little action scene montage-y thing. So it had a very trailery vibe. Yeah, in 2017, after we sort of worked on it for a year, I took it to LA. At that point, I wasn't sure if we would ever make that movie because who knows, right? It's just like I showed it to a few people and they were like, oh, yeah, this is okay. It's good. But not like, oh, yeah, this needs to be a movie. So I was pretty stunned when we sort of, when I ran into the, had the first few meetings. And the first meeting in LA was actually, cool thing, I like cool trailer, but do you have a script? I'm like, nope, no script. And then, well, sorry then, bye. And I was like, fantastic. This is off to a great start. So, but funnily enough, four meetings later, and like due to the fact that these people were super nice and super supportive, four phone calls later, I had a meeting with Sam Raimi, who was like, this is very cool. I like this. I see a movie in there. And I was like, fantastic. And literally sort of shook hands at the end of the meeting. I was like, let's do this. That was an amazing day. Starting with that, sort of the tide changed and suddenly the trailer was sort of everywhere and suddenly it had this momentum and we started working on a script. And yeah, that was the beginning. But it wasn't like super cut and dry. It was like, oh yeah, this is a fantastic product and we need to sell it now. It was sort of, yeah, like Sam had to come in at that point and go like, this is good. And it got the Sam seal of approval at that point. And yeah, that was immensely important for us.
I was actually going to ask you about working with him. Did he have any kind of particular advice that stuck with you during the process?
There were literally a lot of advice going on where it was working, where we wrote a script and then he gave feedback and then he talked about it and he was asking the right questions. So it was super respectful to my process and the writer's process and sort of always taking care that he's not sort of pushing his into his direction or where he would go. So sort of, yeah, supporting the way we wanted to go. And that's sort of the kind of guy he is. And that's started from start to finish. Even in the editing, it was the same sort of same approach, and it was fantastic. And really, like I learned a lot from him.
And I guess kind of jumping ahead to the final film, what really kind of anchors it is this incredible central performance from Bill Skarsgård's character Boy. What made you want to kind of get him involved in the film? Had you seen him in something and thought, yeah, this is the person I want for that?
I saw him in obviously the It movies and the couple more movies. And I was like, yeah, fantastic actor. But I would be lying if I told you I was like pointing at him going like, yeah, he needs to be the next action guy, because I didn't. And I didn't know. And I didn't even know he was sort of interested in that. And we were looking at one point, we were looking at action guys, like who can do the action, who can do a lot of the action themselves, so we don't have to double everything. And it was sort of this sort of coming from a very practical side. And somebody suggested Bill. And I was like, wait, would he do it? And he's like, yeah, he would. We talked to him. I mean, he's amazing. He's super expressive with his face. He's like that. That alone is sort of one big selling point for Boy. Yeah, very physical actor. And yeah, no action movies that sort of come to mind. And I had his first call with him and he was amazing. And was like, so yeah, we got that covered. The acting part, of course, you would knock it out of the park. I know that. But are you up for sort of doing that kind of action? And he's like, absolutely. Big MMA UFC fan. I want to get in shape. I want to train. I want to do this the right way. And I was like, okay, if you say so, I'm inclined to trust you there. That's literally when he started, like, I don't know when, but just a few months later when we sort of getting into, I think he finished up a project and then he was like, all right, I'm ready, guys. And then we sent somebody over to Stockholm to train with him, sort of the basics. He really, really committed to that part. And when I saw him on the first day of shooting without a shirt, that was something. Yeah, he really delivered on his promise. That's what I was getting at. And he knocked it out of the park performance-wise on both the action side and the drama side.
I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about your kind of influences when creating this world. I know you've spoken in the past a bit about being influenced by anime and manga and video games. I was just wondering if there were any kind of particular titles that kind of influenced you when making it.
So one movie I was particularly influenced about, because if you sort of talk about revenge movies, one of my favorite directors also is Park Chan-wook, and just his the revenge trilogy, Old Boy, Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. That's sort of how to make a modern revenge movie, I guess. All of these three movies blew me away when I first watched them, and I was very heavily inspired by that part. Sort of the visual style comes from this thing where he's like, all right, let's make a comic book movie, but without a comic book. Let's create this weird, colorful world that is fun, but also really dark. I feel like this is something that's been done mostly combined with how it actually looks in the movie. That's something that definitely comes from the comic book realm. Lady Snowblood, also a fantastic revenge movie. Kill Bill, which is sort of also in the same realm. Dave, our action director, Dave Shatarsky, and the writers, Aaron Dremmers and Tyler Burton Smith, everybody took the craziest ideas and the things that I really like about these kind of movies and sort of just pushed this into our world. Also, in the beginning, since we're not based on reality and created our own world, we sort of were able to do that and include like the fun stuff and the stuff that we really like about these movies.
Yeah, I think it also kind of makes it a really unique looking film because it's drawing from all those different kind of realms for sure. The film is rated R in the US and 18 in the UK, and I think it really, really earns that rating with the with the violence in it. Did you always know you were kind of going and gunning for that to kind of make sure it was really, really out there?
That's been something I've been doing in like my work. The few short films that I made was always like over the top and violent and fun. That was always like something I was going for. The great thing is, if Sam Raimi is your producer, nobody really questions that. It's the just like, oh yeah, so yeah, that makes sense. There weren't even any discussions like, oh, we need to tone the violence down or anything. We always knew we were going for R, and producers were totally on board for it. And I think we had like a couple of moments where he was like, maybe not. Sam actually said that because like everybody sort of needs to get what they deserve on the violence scales. You can't kill that poor henchman in such a horrible, horrible way that people would go like, oh, that's a bit much. So you really need to reserve the mean kills for the mean guys. If you are too mean, then you lose your audience, and it doesn't also make it feels wrong, really. So that's something we kept in mind, and I know Dave too, because there was this moment in one of the early previews where we just killed this guy, and it was just horrible. It was just like, oh my God, could you just stop now? This is horrible. Stop it. And it was like, yeah, okay, all right, we cut it out. Like it was sort of a completely different previs for a diff almost a different scene that it's not in a movie anymore. But it was like that's something where we learned something about how to do that in the future. So it was good learning experience.
Yeah, and you got really creative, I think, with the kills in the action scenes as well. There's a particular cheese grater sequence that is going to stick with me for a while.
That's good. Very good. That's
Also,
how
it
to
feels like
plan.
cheese graters are having a bit of a moment right now.
Exactly. I told this before, but it's like we were sh ready to shoot this, and Zainab Azizi, who is Sam Raimi's producer on the movie, was like, "Hey, Moritz, didn't I tell you there's a cheese grater in Evil Dead Rise?" And we were literally standing on set to shoot this, and I was like, "Are you kidding me? You're telling me now?" And then she was like, "Yeah, but it's not that long, and this is different." And then I actually watched it, and I was like, "All right, this is fine." But again, what are the odds? Like for this two movies with two cheese graters, it's both done by Sam Raimi or produced by Sam Raimi. It's a bit crazy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we were talking a bit before about like your influences, but one of the things I've seen of kind of early reactions are lots of comparisons to John Wick as well. I was just wondering what you thought about that.
I mean, that's an honor to some degree, because like these films are just amazing. I think we sort of coming from a slightly different angle there. We sort of tried to make a martial arts movie, and then we added some guns to it. Whereas John Wick add some had guns, and then it sort of added some martial arts to it, even more towards the later installments of the series. So those are gorgeous looking action movies with top-notch action. So if people want to compare them, I'm all for it.
And just finally, the world of Boy Kills World is so fully realized and really unique. I was just wondering whether it was something you kind of hope in the future you might come back to in a sequel or so, anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. The thing is, with not being a big studio movie and sort of being an indie, we sort of really have to wait for how people like the movie, how it performs. Then we can talk about this. But up until then, we need to wait and fingers crossing. And but yeah, there is a lot of stories I'd love to tell, and a lot of ideas are already in place.
So that was Moritz Moore on Boy Kills World. I haven't seen this yet, Matthew, but what did you make of this film?
Well, I mean, interestingly, it's been quite a good year for one-man army films. Cause we started off with The Beekeeper, which I'm quite a big fan of. I'm slightly ashamed to admit. And then last month we had Monkey Man, which was another kind of man on a rampage film, also starring Sharlto Copley in a sort of comic relief role. And he pops up here again in a comic relief role. But unlike Monkey Man, there's a lot more emphasis on comedy, kind of dark comedy. This is kind of partly a satire, as you mentioned. Boy has this inner voice, and that provides a lot of the humor. But it does also rival Monkey Man for bloodshed, throat trauma here. If you enjoyed that scene in Monkey Man, there's a bit more of that here. But this is slightly more sort of cartoony and video gamey. I mean, there are references, open references to video games, and it's very, very stylized. It sort of reminded me a bit of Matthew Vaughn at times in some of the fight choreography. And there's elements of things like the Hunger Games and Running Man. It's kind of a media satire.
Okay.
And, yeah, and at the middle of it all, you've got Bill Skarsgård. I mean, he's kind of never not intense in any of his roles, but he's particularly intense here because he's this kind of focused, wiry, muscular man who's out to avenge his family. And there's a few twists along the way, but it is very sort of straightforward. You know, the good guys, the bad guys. Meeting in the middle, lots of bloodshed and carnage. Kind of fun, kind of enjoyed it. I found it maybe a little bit on the sort of shallow and repetitive side. It feels like it kind of needs to keep trying to top itself, going, you know, higher and higher, pushing further and further. So it gets a bit desensitized to it by the end. But there's some fun performances, particularly I enjoyed Michelle Dockery. She's this kind of media manager, sort of PR person, struggling to keep everything on board, you know, very sort of callous and calculating, but great fun. You know, she's very sort of swish and stylish as well. I thought she kind of overshadowed some of the other villains. I mean, the sort of the ultimate big bad here is Famke Janssen. But for my money, I thought Michelle Dockery was the more fun antagonist. So yeah, if you like this sort of thing, of this sort of rampage movie with lots of kind of video game and anime influences, I don't think you'll be dissatisfied with this if this is your bag.
On a kind of John Wick scale, like if we sort of think of John Wick 4 as just the ultimate in terms of non-stop action for 3 hours, like how non-stop is the action here? Are there kind of pauses for any sort of plot, or is it pretty much like non-stop fighting throughout?
It's more or less. There's a few sort of similar to Monkey Man, there's a few flashbacks, a few sort of backstory moments, but otherwise, yeah, it's just full-on carnage, especially in the second half. Yeah, and things get more sort of inflated. You get characters kind of dressed up in these very elaborate sort of costumes. It's a bit like The Masked Singer as well. Sort of, you imagine there's a giant pineapple kind of wandering around at one point. Yeah, it's not sort of a film to be taken seriously. No. But that device of having the voiceover, that works well because he kind of provides a sort of nice sort of counterpoint and running commentary on what's going on the screen. And so that's kind of a gift that keeps on giving. But I think it did sort of wear out its welcome a bit by the end. He kind of gets a bit exhausting. But yeah, good fun altogether, really.
Yeah, it's funny because obviously when you just look at like a very simple synopsis on paper, it does seem so similar to Monkey Man, doesn't it? Just because even the fact of there being like a kind of matriarch of this sort of crime syndicate, and the fact he's called Boy and he's kind of known as Kid in Monkey Man as well. It's just obviously that was obviously a much more serious take on it by the sounds of this.
Yeah, and there's similarities with Beekeeper as well. it feels like a real trend this year. I've never been able to, I mean, I grew up on things like Rambo and Commando. I do have a soft spot for this subgenre, as ludicrous and implausible as it is. It's always quite fun to watch.
I'm the same as well, yeah. I am a sucker for a one-man army film. So that is Boy Kills World. And if you like the sound of that, that is in cinemas from this Friday, the 26th of April. Next up, it's time to hit the court with this one.
What are you going to do now?
Unfortunately, my only skill in life is hitting a ball with a racket.
I want you to be my coach.
I want you to be my coach.
How often does this happen? Going after the same girl? Come here.
Which one of us?
So this is Challengers, which you might have heard a lot about because it's got quite a lot of buzz already, hasn't it, Matthew? And it was originally scheduled to kind of come out last year and open the Venice Film Festival. But due to the sort of SAG strike, it got postponed. So like its hot cast would be able to promote it by the time it came out. And now it's kind of, you know, about to come out around the world. But it's obviously set in the world of competitive professional tennis. At the centre is this sort of love and friendship triangle. And in there, you've got Tashi Duncan, who's played by Zendaya. You've got Patrick Zweig, who's played by Josh O'Connor. And you've got Art Donaldson, who's played by Mike Feist, who you might remember from Spielberg's West Side Story. And basically, this is one of those stories where we jump back and forward in time a lot. But where we find things at the beginning, Tashi and Art are married at this point at the beginning, and Tashi kind of suffered an injury quite early on in her career, sort of ruling out a longer time of actually playing tennis herself, and she moved into coaching, and she ends up coaching Art, and he's gone professional and done pretty well for himself. He's kind of a Grand Slam winner. Right at the beginning, we find him in this, what's referred to as like a challenger tournament, which I didn't really know much about. I know like a little bit about tennis. I enjoy watching Wimbledon when it's on, of course. And it's like one of the few sports I've ever actually played, not to any sort of serious level, yeah. But I can kind of hold a racket and, compared to my lack of sort of competence in any other sport, you know, I vaguely consider myself being able to play tennis. But anyway, sorry, yes, but I wasn't aware of these. But it's this kind of like sort of second tier tennis competition to sort of prepare you for the, you know, the main competitions. And in some cases, like in the case of Art, it's sort of a practice run to get his confidence back. Before he kind of embarks on aiming for his last kind of, you know, major Grand Slam win that he's hoping for. And then for Patrick, who's also competing, for him, it's like a chance to get a shot at being, you know, a competitor in one of these bigger titles. So they're coming at it from different angles, you know, and with slightly different reasons. But the stakes are very high. And so we're introduced to him at this match. You know, there's clearly some tension going on. Tashi's obviously watching nervously from the sidelines. And then basically the film then jumps back 13 years and we go back to see Patrick and Art as sort of best friends. And they're sort of a doubles team known as Fire and Ice. And they're just kind of best buds from this kind of tennis boarding school. But that is kind of thrown into disarray when they meet the young Tashi, both obviously really fancy her basically and kind of excited by her. She's obviously she's at this really exciting stage in her career where it's clear that she's going to go on to big things. She's clearly like a great, exciting talent. They kind of get to know each other a little bit. There's a bit of sort of sexy shenanigans going on between them. And then how it all ends up is that obviously we know that Tashi ends up married to Art and Patrick ends up a bit sort of down on his luck. And then basically the film then keeps bouncing back between these different time periods. And I don't know, Matthew, if you would agree, because you've seen the film as well, but if this is just like a metaphorical stretch too much. Mm. And if I was just thinking this because I was in a tennis mood, or if you think it's legitimate. But almost the timeline made me think of like a tennis ball bouncing on a court, because you're kind of going from one end, like the kind of extreme, the full length of the court is this 13 years between their sort of first meeting with Tashi and their final, you know, their final match that we're seeing play out. And then it kind of like sometimes it goes all the way back and forth to the, you know, the end of the court. And then other times it will jump back like just a few years. Then sometimes within those sort of flashbacks, you'll jump back, you know, another couple of weeks or a few days. So there's a lot of jumping around. And I mean, despite that, I did find it was pretty fine to follow it despite this jumping around. It's one of those classic cases where they're really helped by their haircuts, basically to establish where you are. And I thought they actually did a pretty good job, really, of the kind of aging them through hair. I thought they it was really quite effective. That I did kind of believe Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist as these much younger versions of those characters, and Zendaya as well. But yes, but that's the basic setup. So it comes down to this really intense tennis match where there's clearly so much sort of, you know, bubbling underneath the surface, and there's more than just kind of this tennis match at stake. The film almost, in some ways, almost plays out like a bit of a mystery in the way that you kind of keep learning new bits of information depending on where you're kind of jumping to in the timeline. Even though it's a very sort of simple story, more and more is kind of revealed as you go along. Yes, so I mean, I've said enough on this now, Matthew, but I know from briefly speaking to you after this, you actually weren't the biggest fan of this, were you? Even though this has got like, it's got, I'm interested to hear your thoughts, because you are sort of in the minority really on this.
I am, yeah.
In that it's got very, very strong reviews across the board. But yeah, so what was it you didn't particularly like about this? You know, I did enjoy it a lot, so I'll kind of come in afterwards, but you serve first.
Well, there were things I did like and admire about it, but essentially I just didn't like these three characters. I found them immensely annoying, selfish, vain, self-centered, which I think is very much deliberate. I don't think you're supposed to kind of, you know, this isn't a kind of traditional sort of romance, or it's not sort of rose-tinted the way a lot of sports movies are. It's not a kind of classic underdog tale, so that's kind of refreshing. See, I mean, they're almost more like chess players, the way they play these kind of mental games with each other. But yeah, I just got immensely irritated with all three of them. And they are really the only three. There's some other like very sort of slight supporting characters. There's a child who has no role in proceedings. But you're spending the whole time with these characters, and this film is like 130 minutes. So I just got very, very tired of their shenanigans, their back and forth. So yeah, that really put me off. I didn't feel invested until kind of towards the end, when the match kind of starts to heat up. And I thought that aspect worked well, that you see this match at the start and it feels like it's going to be quite sort of small stakes, a bit sort of inconsequential. But as the film goes on, you realise there's much more at stake in this final match. So when you get to the resolution, you are kind of more, I certainly was more invested, more excited. And the other thing that annoyed me was the music, which I liked in itself, but I felt like it smothered every scene. I mean, it kind of chips in. Even in like the quietest dialogue exchange, I found it very intrusive. But again, I think this, you know, it's very much a deliberate artistic choice. You know, I think the director is totally in control of his material. But yeah, I just found it kind of a turn off, really, altogether.
That music is by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who I just always love their film scores. And I actually really like this. And it is kind of like intense, because it's this kind of pounding, like techno type score, isn't it? And it's sort of, it's loud and it's really kind of insistent and fast paced, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, but I actually, again, I kind of like it just with this kind of heightened sort of emotions of the film, and the sort of the tension and the sexual chemistry as well. Yeah, it's interesting, because I do think that those are sort of, it's fair points that you've made, and I can see people feeling that about the characters, but I just got completely sort of sucked into it. And I thought all those three, I thought they gave very good performances. Zendaya is very, and again, I can see some people not liking this, but she's so kind of inscrutable as this character, Tasha, that she's just got such a stern face for most of it, and isn't really giving anything away. And obviously that's part of the film, that from the sidelines you're not sure who she's actually rooting for and why. Then I kind of thought with all the characters, I sort of like the fact that they were all kind of, you know, all very three-dimensional to me. I thought with all of them, they had things you sort of could like about them and dislike about them. Like, and Josh O'Connor's Patrick was probably perhaps the one I was more drawn to. He has this kind of rakish quality to him, and he's got this kind of underdog quality, and there's this kind of thing that runs throughout the film, this kind of tension that you sort of see him as the better tennis player, don't you, ultimately, that right from the beginning, when we know the two guys are going to be having a singles match in the early part of the story, you know, timeline wise they're due to have a singles match, and there's kind of discussion about Patrick letting Art win to kind of, you know, for it to kind of benefit his career or whatever. So there's kind of that feeling from the beginning that he's perhaps the better tennis player, but then Art is kind of, he just clearly kind of manages his career a bit better and sort of looks after himself, sort of is a bit more like technical minded, I suppose. And I thought they just did a good job of contrasting those characters. Yeah, and I did find it was that weird thing because fairly long film. It's just is really just focused on these characters, like you say. That there's a couple of other people in there, but they don't really get any real sort of screen time or dialogue to speak of or anything. But I really was kind of gripped at how it kind of played out, and I thought that was just really well handled.
It must have worked on me in some way because I was kind of caught up in the finale, and I felt like they sort of pulled out all the stylistic stops for the finish. The camera work and the editing,
and it's I thought as well just the tennis sequences were just really well done, I thought, because it really throws you right in there in the court with them a lot of the time, sometimes even putting you in the perspective of the ball being like batted sort of back and forth. But it's you really kind of feel the sort of the thwack of the ball on the racket, like in the screening I saw it, and it was like really loud. That was just another element of it that was kind of loud and intense, and it like kind of in an over the top, like intentionally over the top way. It's sort of so sweaty. We kind of just start by seeing them in slow motion with these kind of massive like beads of sweat like dripping off their faces. You really feel the heat of where they're having that match, don't you? That kind of the key match that's sort of playing out. When that injury does occur, which happens fairly early on, and you kind of see it in the trailer, that it feels really painful. It was like gasps in the screening that I saw. I've largely seen sort of 4 and 5 star reviews for this. Like on the kind of first viewing, it fell for me in the sort of what I would class as like a high 4. I really liked the ending, but the ending left me with a couple of like questions to sort of mull over, really. And I'm interested to see how it plays on like a repeat viewing, but I won't go into it here. But I left not 100% sure how to sort of interpret the ending. And what I thought was interesting, I don't know if you felt differently because of your bigger dislike of the characters. I wasn't really rooting for one over the other either in terms of the guys playing tennis, which was interesting the way they managed to make it tense, but without having like as such a sort of like a hero and a villain sort of character where one's the goodie that you want to win and one's the baddie who could kind of upset things while we're in there. They both kind of, you know, you sort of have legitimate reasons for wanting both to win, really.
I felt for the umpire because he's sitting there in the middle of this kind of weird psychosexual tension, psychological warfare thinking, what is going on with these people?
I mean, I haven't watched as much tennis, like real tennis in recent years as I sort of did when I was younger. There was a lot of racket smashing in this as well, like
a lot of code violations.
Does that happen a lot in modern tennis? Is it just something I'm sort of not used to because of not watching as much anymore? Yeah. But there was a hell of a lot of whacking tennis rackets, and then it was also just interesting to me as someone who's never kind of lost it so much on a tennis court that I've tried to sort of smash a racket, but they just seem much harder to break than you'd expect. Like I'd expect, like if you whacked a tennis racket on the floor, they would just snap instantly, but they have to really go for it in order to get it to break, don't they?
Quite a lot of racket violence. So I mean, if you're disturbed by that, I would steer clear. I think it's interesting. I don't think I've ever seen a sports movie that has so much sport in it but isn't actually really about the sport itself. It's about, you know, what's going on underneath the surface. Yeah, I can't really think of any, Moneyball, but even Moneyball didn't have as much kind of sporting content as this film does.
There's so much sport in it, so much tennis played in it. But I didn't come away from it thinking of it as a sports movie, strangely.
And
I would say as well, so we haven't really discussed Guadagnino much, but obviously kind of, if you're, you know, most people will be familiar with some of his films, but I'd say probably his most famous film is Call Me By Your Name, but he's also made like I Am Love, A Bigger Splash. He did the remake of Suspiria, Bones and All, most recently. But I would say this is easily his most kind of commercial film, his most sort of mainstream, easy to watch film. And I would say that not as like an insult either. Often, you know, if a director kind of got to that point, you might think, oh, they've sold out or something, but just doesn't feel like it's sold out at all. And it still has a lot of his kind of key preoccupations, but just in a very mainstream package, and just which I personally found it very very compelling. And it was the kind of film I could see recommending to a lot of people, because it's also one of those films that, interestingly, it's kind of sexy in terms of like, you know, the tension between the characters in certain moments, but it's not really kind of like a particularly graphic film or anything like that.
Quite a few buttocks.
Yeah. A few buttocks, a bit of locker room sort of antics, but I could see it having a lot of mainstream appeal, really.
It was Zendaya, so kind of hot right now, isn't she? She's so buzzy from Dune Part 2 and everything else that she does.
Josh O'Connor is obviously very, very kind of popular as well. And to be honest, I would be very, very happy if this did really well at the box office, because it would just be sort of interesting to see a kind of, you know, like basically a relationship drama do well on that kind of scale. So I will be kind of watching closely to see how well that does. But yes, let's see. We'll find out soon enough, because you can go and see Challengers in cinemas from this Friday, the 26th of April.
You cannot be serious!
And now we're heading into space with our next film.
Down to Gonky Park, listening to the wind of change.
Wow. I mean, I've seen pictures, but this is...
We don't talk politics. Here we're one.
Hey, guys.
Wait a minute, what the hell is going on down there?
Oh, whoa.
We gotta get up now, guys.
Let's get out.
Oh, my God.
This is ISS. Matthew, could you set this one up for us, please?
Yeah, so ISS. So, yeah, it's the initials for the International Space Station, the joint US-Russian endeavor. And this film starts with the main character is played by Ariana DeBose. She's an American astronaut who's joining the ISS. She's joining the other crew. We've got there's two other Americans and three Russians. So she joins them, and they carry on with their research projects. They kind of get rub along quite nicely, all of them. But then there's a very, very serious incident down on Earth that creates significant east-west tensions, and essentially these tensions then are kind of replicated on board the space station. So it comes down to a battle of wills between the two sides. I mean, fair play to it, it does kind of tap into current tensions. It doesn't sort of shy away from those. It's not a kind of like revenge of nature type disaster movie, although it does have elements of disaster to it. So yeah, it's very much a kind of tight sort of claustrophobic tense thriller. We do get some sort of a bit of spectacle outside of the space. There's inevitably a space walk at some point. We're not a spoiler course, to say that. Yeah. They do go outside, someone goes outside, but most of the action is confined to all the corridors and the little nooks and crannies and tiny little spaces in zero gravity of the space station. And we're kind of left to work out who's on what side, who's going to do what next, how is this going to escalate. But very much sort of sticking with the point of view of the Ariana DeBose character. She's the kind of the central focus of this.
You might even think from the title that it was sort of like a horror, but is it more like a sort of politically tinged thriller then?
Yeah, there's no, yeah, it's supernatural. It's not, you can really call it science fiction. There's no sort of element of that. It's very much about tensions. But yeah, the kind of traditional sort of people kind of locked in a small space fighting it out. It's sort of similar to Gravity in some ways, but doesn't have that kind of the great spectacle of Gravity. Perhaps sort of similar to Apollo 13, except there's, yeah, things are much more tense and kind of dangerous. Mm. But it's sort of people in this tight space trying to figure out, solve problems. But very much a sort of a metaphor for east-west tensions going on.
And so it's obviously not like the biggest budget film, but does it look nice still? Have they done a kind of decent job on a low budget?
Yeah, I think, yeah, they really have actually. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the interiors, I thought, found them very convincing. It kind of looks like it's, you know, it looks like a lived in place. You know, when she comes aboard, the Ariana DeBose character, it feels like people have been living in this space for a while. Not everything's kind of clean and shiny, and there's all these sort of mementos lying around. You can tell people actually do live here. So, and the zero gravity is kind of handled quite well. So yeah, I thought production design was definitely one of its strongest suits, and the few scenes where it is outside and when you get these views of Earth and see what's going on, they look quite convincing as well. So it's kind of both sort of claustrophobic and kind of agoraphobic. I was kind of getting quite tense when they're outside, sort of floating in the ether, but when they're inside as well. So yeah, it works quite well from that point of view. But it is kind of quite formulaic as well. It's quite schematic the way things are worked out. The tensions between the characters, the way you have there's kind of like an equal number of characters you can root for on each side, but also characters you don't root for, and it did feel a little bit implausible as well, the way some characters act out of sort of necessity of making this plot kind of motor along. Some characters, I felt, they give them certain orders and they sort of act on them immediately, which felt a bit sort of rash and not quite believable. But it is all in service of kind of motoring this this quite tight sort of 90-minute thriller along.
How did you find Ariana DeBose in the sort of lead role? Because she obviously won the supporting Oscar for West Side Story a couple of years ago. And then she, I mean, had a tiny role in Argyle earlier this year. So how is she here?
Yeah, really good. Yeah, she's sort of instantly kind of inherently likable. You really root for her as this character. She's your viewpoint character. So there are some sort of tensions and things going on between the other characters that you don't know about, but you see them through her point of view. So you learn along with her. And yeah, she's your sort of classic kind of resourceful hero, sort of plunged in at the deep end, trying to make things work. So yeah, she's a very sort of solid focus for the movie. But it does feel like the characters, kind of a lot of them are sort of stock types in a way. I did find that, especially and the more it went on, the less sort of plausible and involving it got. But it's generally a sort of a well-made, well-performed movie, I would say, overall.
Would you actually recommend it? Is it sort of recommended for cinemas? Do you think it kind of gains anything in the cinema that it wouldn't sort of lose anything on a small screen if you waited?
I think small screen would be okay. It even though it kind of addresses these sort of really big topical issues, it does have a very sort of B movie feel to it. And even though it is kind of impressively rendered on its budget, and a lot of these, the space station scenes do look good on a big screen. Yeah, I think this would be a more sort of comfortable viewing on streaming, watching on your TV. I don't think it would lose a great deal, really, to be honest.
But if you do fancy catching that in the cinemas, that is ISS, and that is also in cinemas from this Friday. And now, moving on to a true life tearjerker.
Hi, Sharon, remember me?
Yes, ma'am.
So she's going to help out a few nights a week.
I met this woman. She's a mess.
Perfect. She'll fit right in. And I'm going to put together a press kit for Michelle, get corporate donations, that kind of thing.
We don't need to be running around worried about money and bills right now. I just want to be with my family.
Life's about saying yes and then figuring out how. Girls, help your daddy out.
So that was Ordinary Angels. This is one, I saw this one this week. You haven't seen it yet, have you, Matthew? But I kind of went into it. I didn't realise that this was actually inspired by a true story, sort of in 90s Louisville in Kentucky. Basically, when we open, we sort of meet Ed, who's played by Alan Ritchson, best known for Reacher, obviously, on Prime Video. He's in hospital, and his sort of second young daughter has just been born to his wife, who's played by Amy Acker, if you sort of remember her from some of those kind of, early 21st century TV shows, like, and a lot of Joss Whedon shows she was in. But she's only in this briefly, as you'll learn soon. But so we see the baby being born, and then quite sort of effectively, actually, it sort of took me by surprise, we sort of cut to 5 years later, where she's kind of, basically on her deathbed in the same hospital, about to die from this kind of unexpected illness. Basically, this is right at the beginning of the film. So she's kind of died, and Ed is left to raise the sort of two daughters, because this was his second daughter that we saw being born at the first film, and he's got another daughter a few years older. And the second daughter, whose name is Michelle, has got this kind of serious illness that basically means she's going to need a liver transplant, and she's, not that high up the list. She keeps having these kind of episodes where she's rushed into hospital, and it's kind of costing the uninsured Ed like a hell of a lot of money, and he's obviously in a kind of, a very bad place. But into his life comes a hairdresser called Sharon, who's played by Hilary Swank. In this film, at least, I don't know if this is the case in real life, but in this film, she's like an alcoholic. We kind of, meet her sort of on a big night out at the beginning, find her sort of hungover. And she's got a friend who she works with, who's called Rose, played by Tamala Jones. And she basically kind of stages like something of an intervention, tries to get her to go to AA, but Sharon's not really sort of having any of it. But something kind of sticks with her about sort of finding a kind of purpose outside of herself. And sort of by chance, she sees this sort of story in the local paper about this girl who's kind of, whose mum had died, and she's sort of desperately ill herself and in need of a liver. And then she kind of just takes it upon herself, really, to sort of start helping them. and slowly sort of inveigles, or I say slowly, not really that slowly, kind of bullishly sort of inveigles her way into the family. Initially starts with a sort of a big sponsored hair cutting marathon to sort of raise a bit of money for them. And from there, she basically kind of keeps trying to help and sort of push whilst obviously dealing with her own sort of demons. It's one of those films that you may have kind of gathered this from what I've said already, that it's kind of extremely, extremely sentimental. A lot of the dialogue is on the sort of cliched side. I was surprised to learn that it's written by Kelly Fremon Craig, who is behind The Edge of 17 and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And it's also written by Meg Tilly, if you remember, the actor, Jennifer Tilly's sister. So I was kind of just surprised. They kind of surprised me that it was by those. And it's produced by Dave Matthews as well, if you're familiar with his music. So kind of quite a strange provenance, this film, and directed by John Gunn, who I don't think I've seen any of his films before, but he's directed things like American Underdog, starring Zachary Levi, and a lot of his films seem to have like a kind of religious aspect, which this does too. But to me, it didn't feel like it fully crossed over into like what I would describe as like kind of, you know, faith-based cinema. But there is a bit of kind of, you know, talking about God and faith and sort of prayers in it, but it doesn't kind of become one of those films where it's about, you know, kind of, there's no kind of divine intervention in this film, right, or anything like that. And yeah, and so basically it's very, very sentimental. Like kind of a lot of the dialogue is very sort of on the nose and feels very obvious. There's like very, very kind of sentimental, cheesy musical cues right from the beginning. Hilary Swank's got this really sort of over the top like southern accent, and she's real kind of like that kind of in your face, like salt of the earth type character. Alan Richardson's very kind of like stoic, and you know, he's obviously bottling up all his feelings and just gruffly trying to like, you know, keep going for his family. It was one of those films that as it kind of went on, I did get kind of like fairly swept up in it, to be honest. And it just kind of worked for what it was, really, I thought. And I feel like this just doesn't sound like your type of film. You're just not going to go and see it. And it typically wouldn't really be the sort of film that would be like, you know, massively on my radar. In terms of what it was trying to do, there was something quite effective about it. I did kind of shed a few tears. It kind of ratchets up to a sort of a bit of a race against the clock type ending as well. And there is some sort of like, you know, there's kind of like just heartwarming stuff about like, you know, people finding redemption and communities coming together and stuff like that. And so I thought it was like, ultimately I would give it like 3 stars if we're talking sort of star ratings in terms of reviews and things. But it was just kind of like solidly put together, I thought. I kind of, again, despite finding Hilary Swank's kind of accent a bit annoying to begin with, I did kind of warm to those two as a sort of a pairing, and I did like them. And I'm intrigued to look up how much of it is real, because there's times where things do feel a bit implausible, where she kind of, marches into places and demands things and sort of gets away with it, manages to sort of like charm her way through or convince people to sort of donate quite kind of, you know, crazy things. So I don't know how much it's true, but yeah, there was just something kind of heartwarming and effective about it. And my mum would love it. It definitely falls into that category. I'd happily watch it again with my mum, you know, at home probably. Again, I'd say I'd be interested to see how well this does at the box office, especially in the UK. It does have a slight kind of like TV movie sort of hallmark kind of vibe about it as well. But yeah, but like actually, to be honest, it sort of surprised me. Overall, I'd go as far as say I enjoyed it. You know, it was very solidly put together, touching story. Like I said, I didn't even realise until towards the end that it was a true story when kind of saw a date, and I was like, okay, right, this there was a very specific date. So I sort of thought, oh, this must be a true story. And then you kind of get a classic bit of you know, the info at the end where you see some real pictures and stuff. Decent little film if you like that sort of thing. And in terms of like another throwback, I was surprised to see Nancy Travis in it as well. Yeah, she plays like the mother of Alan Richardson's character, like the kind of grandmother of the daughters, and she's sort of living with them to sort of help out after the wife has died. So another sort of throwback.
That makes me feel old. She's playing Jack Reacher. Oh man. Yeah. I want to watch a film that reminds me how old I'm getting.
Yes, there you go though. Yeah. But so if you do fancy that, that is Ordinary Angels, which is also, like all the films this week, in cinemas from Friday, the 26th of April. And finally, we're going animated for our last film this week.
この娘を殺せ! 戦争になる。
諦めるのはまだ早いです。
マイクロフィルムの彗星に世界の命運がかかっている。
This is Spy X Family, Code White. Or I don't know if we're just going full Godzilla Kong and just calling it Spy Family, Code White. However we're going to say it, Matthew, yeah. For anyone who's unfamiliar, could you sort of set this up?
This is a movie that's based on an anime series that's based on a manga. And it's got this wildly kind of contrived, ridiculous setup. Essentially, the family is kind of a makeshift family. At the center of it is the spy himself, who's been hired to get married and find a child, because he needs a child to infiltrate this private school in order to get to someone to stop some east-west tensions from exploding. So it's this ridiculous kind of mix of kind of spy games and domestic comedy. But the sort of the hook is that these characters don't know. Like the spy finds a wife who is secretly an assassin, but she doesn't know her husband is a spy. The child that they adopt is telepathic, but they don't know that. And the dog that they adopt can see the future. So it's got all these kind of ludicrous elements going on, but in a very sort of knowing, comedic way. And the movie very much kind of carries on in this vein of having... I mean, it's kind of almost split in two. Like the first half is kind of like a domestic comedy, all about finding this recipe for this cake, because the child needs to win this cake making competition, and that's kind of treated very sort of seriously and urgently, like a kind of almost like a Bond movie. And then in the second half, the hunt for this cake kind of leads into this bigger plot involving mercenaries and a giant exploding airship. So that's where you get all the kind of action. So it's similar. I've watched a few episodes of the TV show, so it's similar in that way. It's kind of, it can be sort of very kind of sort of stylish and lots of kind of swift action. Like the assassin mom, she's kind of absolutely deadly, sort of almost like a computer's kind of programmed to eliminate any threat. But at the same time, she's very sort of demure and not very worldly. And the kid kind of gets, she's very sort of cute and endearing, but she gets mixed up in all these adventures as well. So it has this real sort of balance of action and comedy. And unlike a lot of kind of TV adaptations, it doesn't kind of push the story further. You can kind of watch this in isolation, or you can carry on watching the show, but it doesn't disappoint. That it doesn't, there's no sort of major developments, because it just does what it does really well. Just kind of takes the strongest qualities of the show, the sort of constant misunderstandings and silly gags, and just kind of amplifies them and spins them out for 2 hours. But it didn't sort of feel overstretched, so I thought it was very, very successful from that point of view. And I'm already a fan of the TV show, so yeah, I very much enjoyed this. I was really looking forward to it, and it didn't disappoint me at all.
So would you say you could just, like someone like me who's never seen the show, could I just kind of get into the film, do you think?
I think so, yeah. They do a kind of catch up right at the start. They kind of explain who all these characters are, what the setup is. I think, you might be slightly bemused by the tone, that the fact that there is so much emphasis on this cake to start with. You're thinking, where's all the spy action? Where's all the kind of the vehicles and the fighting? But you get these sort of interludes of, there's kind of a weird bit of bloodshed near the start, some blood spray, which seemed a bit sort of out of keeping with the rest of it. But yeah, generally is a kind of lighthearted comedy. So yeah, I think you could. I think I've certainly found it more accessible, I think, than like some other anime adaptations that I've seen on the big screen. And I'm absolutely convinced that Hollywood is going to pick up this before long. So I think it lends itself so strongly, the kind of the romantic misunderstandings and the kind of Mr. and Mrs. Smith type angle to it. And the fact that it's got like a cute kid and a lovable dog. I can really see this being picked up for live action before long by Hollywood.
Yeah, I thought that when you mentioned it, I thought, because I had no idea what it was about, but I thought that that premise does sound very, like easy to adapt in that sense. And surprising that they haven't sort of snapped up already. And it's done quite well at the box office, hasn't it? As well, the Japanese box office. And
it entered the top five on its first weekend in America as well. So I think there is a kind of growing fan base. It seems to be one of the more sort of popular mainstream anime shows.
Thanks to sort of Crunchyroll as well, that seems to be doing well, doesn't it? Is that where you've watched the episodes?
Yeah.
Did you see a dubbed version of this, or a subbed?
It was subbed, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if the dub has got any sort of big voices in. Yeah, I don't know. I imagine it wouldn't be on the scale of like The Boy and the Heron, you know, with all those kind of A-listers. But yeah, I found it, yeah, perfectly accessible.
Well, if you fancy the sound of that, that is, well, that's either Spy X Family or Spy Family Code White, which is also in cinemas this Friday, 26th of April. So what is your film of the week this week, Matthew?
I'm going to go with Spy X Family Code White.
Yeah, bearing in mind I haven't seen Boy Kills World or Spy Family yet, I'm going to go for Challengers, which I did think was very good. Like that, it will be hard for either of those films to sort of top it, I think, once I catch up with them. So yeah. I feel fairly confident calling that my film of the week. But
I think it's bigger in like end of year poll.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Given the kind of critical response it's had so far, I'd be surprised if it doesn't. And I wonder as well, I wonder if it will sustain interest when it comes to awards season as well, just because its initial planned kind of premiere for Venice would have very much put it in the sort of, you know, awards window. But now, I mean, we know with Oppenheimer and all that, that they don't have to come out in that traditional window that everyone thought they needed to be remembered for awards. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is in awards contention as well.
Yeah, kind of, you know, where would you put the actors, which category?
Yeah, I know. That was literally so much I thought as I was, you know, came out of the film, that obviously Zendaya has it a bit easier because she could just be lead actress. Yeah. But then it's really tricky for those two, because it's sort of interesting in the sense that they all felt like three leads, didn't they? Like they're just the way they sort of balanced it. It just really didn't feel like there was like the one that you were sort of rooting for. And it didn't feel like one person got more screen time or had that. You know, that one person was driving the story more. It really, really was kind of swirling all around the sort of three of them, which was interesting. We're fast approaching the end of the podcast now, but don't forget to check out the new issue of Total Film Magazine, which is out right now, featuring Furiosa on the cover. There's like an epic cover feature by Jordan Farley there, with new interviews with George Miller, Anya Taylor-Joy, Chris Hemsworth and more. And then, Matthew, you've also got a big feature on Star Wars, The Acolyte, haven't you, in the issue? Yeah.
Whole new era for Star Wars.
So there's that to look forward to. And then there's lots of other exciting stuff in there as well, including Richard Linklater's Hitman, Viggo Mortensen, Benedict Cumberbatch's new Netflix show. And also, as it's like our landmark 350th issue, we've kind of selected the 10 best films to ever have appeared on the cover of the magazine. So just in terms of the best films, not the best covers, but the best films that have been on the cover. And yes, we also selected the 5 worst films that have been on the cover, because there have been a few stinkers over the years. That must be said. We put our hands up to that. So that was very fun to pull that together. And yeah, so that issue is out now as you listen to this. And if you subscribe, not only will you never miss a future issue like this, but with the kind of access to the digital back issues that you get now as a subscriber, you could start reading this issue digitally immediately rather than, you know, having to wait for your first print copy to be delivered, which with the way subscriptions work, that always can take a couple of weeks. So if you would like the idea of reading this, you can subscribe and you'll be able to read it digitally immediately. And if you like this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe to this as well, please, and rate it on your podcast app of choice to help others find us. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, time for just a quick question. What line of dialogue from a movie would you like to apply to a real life situation? Matthew, do you have one in mind for this? It's sort of tricky because there's loads of dialogue that I like, but I'm struggling to think of one off the top of my head.
I don't know, this is some dark impulse that's urging me to say this, and I can't think of a specific instance, but it's a line you hear a lot, and you hear it in trailers, but kill them all, you know, someone who says kill them all immediately. Yeah, but, you know, I wouldn't want to apply that to anything sort of serious or create any sort of loss of life, but it's just sort of the drama and the power of saying that always sticks out to me.
It's always like the insults that kind of stick in your mind as well, isn't it? So like, I don't know why, Matthew, I've literally genuinely got no idea why this stuck in my head the other day. But a line that's just always stuck with me from a film I'd never even watched that many times, but from an actor I know you're very fond of, Eddie Murphy, in The Nutty Professor. And there's a bit where he's in his kind of cool guys, you know, where he's kind of taking the potion and stuff. And he's got this kind of cool car. I can't remember what it is, but I feel like it's some kind of like red Ferrari type car, and he parks it, and as he's handing over the key to the valet or something. He says something like, if there's a scratch on my car, there's a scratch on your ass or something. And it's just always stuck with me. And I was just never, obviously, as I've just proved just now, I'd never be as cool as Eddie Murphy to be able to say that. But yeah. I just, that was just a weird, just completely random line from a film that I did like it when I was younger, but it's not like a favorite film I've kind of stuck with. But I just, that's a line. And for some reason, maybe I walked past a nice car or something the other day, but it just popped back into my head. And so, yeah, I'll go for that. I'd love to be, because I'd love to be in that situation where I had a nice car that I didn't want scratched, and where I was using a valet. But that's it for this week. So thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Three, that's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community, we're born three, Mace, Dove, and me, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure.